This is the Down East Journal on Public Radio East. Agriculture and the military. They both depend on undeveloped areas of eastern North Carolina to exist.
Agriculture needs farms and open space. Military needs farms and open space.
But as more people decide to make eastern North Carolina home, land used for farming and military training is slowly disappearing. The pilot program Food and Fuel for the Forces was initiated in 2009 as a way to mitigate the loss of agricultural lands and forest and preserve areas suitable for training. George Miller is the program manager of the regional partnership.
It was initially implemented by Eastern Region's Military Growth Task Force until 2011 when the Marine Corps picked up funding for it. And so since 2011, it's been a Marine Corps-funded program.
Miller says the Marine Corps will continue to provide funding for the program through the end of 2014. Food and Fuel for the Forces works closely with the Military Growth Task Force, Marine Corps, North Carolina State University, North Carolina Department of Agriculture, and many other organizations. One of the objectives of the program is to leverage food demand at local military bases by supporting local farmers. Cherry Point, Camp Lejeune, and New River spend about $37 million each year on food at the mess halls, most of it coming from Foster Cavanaugh in Greensboro, Charlotte, and Raleigh. Of that, Miller says about $1.5 million is used to purchase fresh fruits and vegetables, money that could go to pay local farmers for produce grown right here in eastern North Carolina.
Our goal is to make sure that, to the extent possible, the things that the Marine Corps buys, they buy from the local farmers. So the local farmers are feeding the local warriors and keeping the economic benefits here close to home.
In addition to providing an economic boost for these growers and the local economy, Miller says they're ensuring training areas for the military.
As long as it's farms and forests, the military can train effectively, fly low, train at night, make loud noises. And so, the military doesn't survive the urbanization of an area. So if we can add value to those lands, additional crop opportunities or additional market outlets, then it helps maintain those lands in their current use and protect them against development and other less compatible uses to military training.
Another objective of Food and Fuel for the Forces is to leverage the Marine Corps' demand for renewable energy and to inspire the growth of a renewable fuels industry in eastern North Carolina. The local military bases are already purchasing biofuel from local companies, but the biofuel is trucked here from other states. Each year, Cherry Point, Camp Lejeune, and New River use an estimated 350,000 gallons of B20 biodiesel that they get from Potter Oil and Tire Company in Aurora. Miller says building a biofuels industry in eastern North Carolina would be good for the environment and the economy.
The eventual use of cellulosic ethanol from trees or forest trash or purpose-grown energy crops would be a benefit to the foresters, and then the possibility of purpose-grown energy crops for oil seeds, camelina, canola, that type of stuff. If the military can utilize their purchasing power to help initiate that industry.
Growing energy crops is new to our area. According to Miller, even though there are currently no commercially purpose-grown energy crop producers in the state, coastal North Carolina is actually an ideal place to grow camelina, canola, soybeans, and switchgrass. Food and Fuel for the Forces began experimenting by planting a 25-acre plot of canola in Jones County in 2011, which has proven to be a small but successful venture.
Crushed it. NC State University had a little mechanical crusher that crushed it for us. And then we spun that into diesel, Piedmont Biodiesel, spun it into biodiesel, and we sold it back to the Marine Corps.
Even if more North Carolina farmers began producing energy crops, the problem, Miller says, is that energy crops, especially canola, can be sold to the food industry for about four times what it's worth for biodiesel. He adds that currently, eastern North Carolina also lacks the real infrastructure to support an energy crop industry.
You can't contract a crop for a refinery that doesn't exist, and you can't build a refinery for a crop that you might not be able to contract. So the whole chicken and the egg thing needs to be broken.
Miller thinks the answer will be found in a partnership between Food and Fuel for the Forces and Green Circle North Carolina's Biodiesel for Schools program. That initiative was started in 2012. In that program, restaurants in Pitt County either donate or sell their used cooking oil to Green Circle North Carolina. Co-owner Dean Price says the discarded oil is taken to Piedmont Biofuels in Pittsboro, where it's made into biodiesel to fuel school buses in Pitt County.
What we're trying to do is to keep the oil in the local community, where we could maybe start a curriculum around teaching the kids how to make biofuel, eventually involving the farmers where we could get a locally made vegetable oil. So it's the blueprint of a biofuels industry in the eastern part of North Carolina.
Price explains how it would be implemented at Camp Lejeune.
Let's take Jacksonville, for example, there in Onslow County. We have talked to the superintendent of schools in Onslow County and feel very confident that we're going to start the program there soon. So what we would do is we would go to the local restaurant owners in Jacksonville and Onslow County throughout the county. We would ask the restaurant owners to either sell back or donate their used cooking oil, which is their garbage, and they in turn split the money with the schools from the proceeds of the oil. And then from there, we would take the oil, convert it into biodiesel, and run the equipment on Camp Lejeune with that oil. So not only is the restaurant owners helping the schools, but they're helping the military to become more sustainable, creating a local energy source, creating a new industry.
Price says the partnership benefits everyone. The restaurants would be recycling used cooking oil, and local schools and the military would benefit from clean biodiesel fuel to power their equipment and vehicles. But this would also be the first baby steps in creating the biofuels industry in eastern North Carolina. Food and Fuel for the Forces program manager George Miller says they hope to someday create a small-scale biodiesel plant of their own in Jacksonville that would encourage local farmers to start growing energy crops.
Much like our first delivery to the military, it's demystifying the process. We're going to build a biodiesel plant based on the feedstocks that we can get now. We're looking to try and put one on the base. That's by no means a near-term thing.
Miller says once a biodiesel refinery is up and running, then a discussion could take place on whether any purpose-grown crops would be of value for local farmers to grow. In the not-so-distant future, Food and Fuel for the Forces plans on promoting the idea of supporting local agriculture by holding a food conference where government entities, local food distributors, and farmers can connect. They've already started promoting buy local initiatives at Cherry Point, Camp Lejeune, and New River. A section at the base's commissaries are dedicated exclusively to products from North Carolina. And in the produce department, fruits and vegetables grown in the region have a label identifying what farm they came from. As far as the Buy Local initiative being implemented at the mess halls, Miller says the menu board will probably highlight what foods are locally grown. Food and Fuel for the Forces also have a vision to work with schools and teach students about the new energy economy that's emerging in our country. Miller says Craven County Schools and Parrot Academy and Kinston have already expressed interest in having a biofuels refinery and training facility. Career and Technical Director for Craven County Schools, Chris Bailey, says it would add to the educational opportunities they currently offer.
We have a mobile biodiesel processor that students actually learn how to create biodiesel from, whether it be canola or from used vegetable oil or whatever. Our hope and dream in this program is to build it into a facility that is going to allow our students to learn the management process behind a biodiesel processing facility as well as the production aspect, and then be able to use that fuel for whether it be our buses or whether it be for governmental vehicles or whatever.
For Public Radio East, I'm Jared Brumbaugh. So far this summer, it seems like it's rained more than it's been sunny. An excessively wet and rainy June has damaged some crops in eastern North Carolina. Lee Jenkins has more on the extent of the damage and what effect it may have on the consumer.
Rain is a good thing. Despite what the Luke Bryan song says, rain isn't always a good thing, especially when there is a lot of it. Typically, counties in eastern North Carolina receive around 4 inches of rain during the month of June, but this year, most counties have received 8 inches or more. National Weather Service meteorologist John Alardo says the coastal plain experienced the heaviest downpours.
Williamston and Martin County reported 13.47 inches of rain. In a normal month, that would have been 4.46. In Bayborough, a little further to the east in Pamlico County, they reported over 11 inches, 11.4 inches, and their normal June rainfall was 4.76.
In Beaufort County, Chocowinity recorded 10.2 inches for the month. Some areas around New Bern also got a lot of rain. At the airport, they received 8.2 inches. Normally, they would get 4.8. James City recorded 10.41 inches. These heavy rains have helped in replenishing groundwater lost to droughts from previous years, but there are drawbacks.
It's going to have some negative effects. It might have some negative effects on agriculture. The rivers are now running above normal, and so that means we're more vulnerable to flooding, especially if we were to get a tropical system that had really, really heavy rain. You know, if we continue to have abnormal rainfall prior to, like, the tropical system, and you throw a tropical system on top of that, then we could, you know, have some really significant flooding.
With another 2 inches of rain projected for the end of this week and Tropical Storm Chantel forming in the Caribbean, the region very well could take an agricultural hit. Farmers are already reporting crop losses and delaying harvests, according to Kelly Putnam of Putnam Farms in Kinston.
The fields are extremely wet, so we are behind on planting. We have some flooding in the fields, which certainly causes you to lose crops, whatever's planted in particular areas that, you know, were heavy.
Putnam grows squash, zucchini, corn, peppers, and more on about 40 acres. Interestingly enough, she expects a better harvest than last year's, where Putnam Farms experienced even heavier rainfall.
Last year at our farm, we had a tremendous amount of rain in a short period of time. And this year, even though we had a lot of rain last week, and certainly it affects us, still overall at this point in time, we're looking at a better season than we did last year.
Still, she's already lost an estimated 30% of her crops, with squash and zucchini taking the most damage. According to Jones County's cooperative extension agent, Jacob Morgan, it's wheat that's turning into nature's punching bag.
Most of the wheat that's in the field has lost value as far as test weight, which is one thing they get paid for. Some of the wheat hasn't been picked yet, which is really the part we're worried about. And just a little bit of rain causes the wheat to increase in moisture content. And at that point in time, there's a dockage at the mill where they sell the wheat. They have to dry it before they can store it.
To make matters worse, the constant rain has caused the seeds in the plant to germinate and sprout, further reducing the value. Soybeans are also in trouble, as delays in planting are stretching out into the end of the planting season.
Soil moisture is too high to get into the field, or the wheat hasn't been picked yet, so they can't plant. That's probably going to be the biggest loss, is those fields that just don't get planted, because we're nearing the end of the recommended planting period. In fact, July 10th is about the latest that, you know, NC State and Cooperative Extension recommends planting soybeans, and still feeling like we have a pretty good chance to make some yield.
Tobacco isn't struggling yet, but if planted on lower ground, it will likely drown. It seems only corn has truly benefited from the rain. But with its growing season still in full swing and more rain on the horizon, it remains to be seen if the crop will stay strong until harvest. But how much rain does it take to damage crops? It depends, though most crops suffer under prolonged rain. The strength of the drainage system and the method used to plant crops also plays a role, as does the quality of the soil.
Sandy land or really well-drained soils, the rain that does fall in those fields will typically soak into the ground a lot faster, and so they've gotten the rainfall they need, and the excess water has been able to drain through the soil profile. They're doing a lot better than some of the soils that hold water better, which are typically our better soils because we usually have, you know, hot, dry periods.
Flooding isn't the only problem caused by excessive rain, though. Fungal growth can also hurt a harvest, explains Mel Parker of the 90-acre Parker Farms in New Bern.
It causes a lot of disease pressure. Anytime you have rain and high humidity like this, you have fungus problems. I've got peaches and have a lot of problems with rot on those at this point.
To cope with this loss of crops, neither Parker Farms nor Putnam Farms plan on raising their prices. However, Kelly Putnam says other farmers in the region may have to.
We have noted that a lot of other farms that are selling at markets did go up on their prices this past weekend. Several other folks that are at markets, they are buying their crops from other farms. And of course, with the shortage that we're seeing with squash, zucchini, melons, things like that, they have no choice but to raise the price up. So if you're buying wholesale, it's going to be more. Therefore, it's going to turn around and affect the customer.
And the delayed harvests will just exacerbate the issue.
You're losing what's already out there and not able to plant more. So the effect will be seen even more so in 2 more weeks.
According to Agricultural Extension Agent Jacob Morgan, a poor harvest won't drastically change the prices in Jones County.
We don't really control the prices of wheat or corn or soybean. Most of that's out in the Midwest and then other parts of the world that are big, a lot bigger producers as far as volume. So even if we had a complete loss and we didn't produce any wheat, then that's really not going to affect, most likely, the wheat prices.
Home gardeners aren't immune to the problems caused by heavy rains either. Wet conditions will allow diseases to flourish and could harm gardens if not kept in check. Morgan says plants also need to be harvested on time. They'll ripen quickly in the well-watered soil and will become overripe if not attended to. I'm Lee Jenkins.
The Downeast Journal is made possible by our members in partnership with East Carolina Neurology, offering a headache clinic specializing in the treatment of options for a full range of headaches, including chronic, hormonal, rebound, migraine, and cluster, online at ecneurology.com.
This is Ann Edwards, Horticulture Extension Agent, with this week's entry in the Garden Journal. It's sweet corn season. And I don't know about you, but it's one of my favorite times of the year. But sometimes you buy sweet corn and it's just not as good as other times. So what is it that you need to look for? What makes good sweet corn? Well, here's a couple of tricks. First of all, you need to know that there are a range of types of sweet corn. The first is called sugar-enhanced sweet corn. This includes some of the varieties, such as Silver Queen. These sugar-enhanced hybrids have the most tender kernels of all. They need to be picked when the kernels are still small, but fully filled in. But they lose sweetness quickly after maturity, even if left on the stalk. Those sugars have turned to starches, and it no longer is as good as you would hope. Also, if it's picked, but then not cooked fairly quickly, those sugars will again turn to starches. So if you like the sugar-enhanced tender kernels like Silver Queen, get to know your farmer, make sure that the ears are picked while still young and tender, and make sure that you buy them the day they're picked, and you at least blanch them, like we talked about last week. The next kind of sweet corn are the super sweets. These are the ones that have very, very shriveled kernels when they're dried. That's because there's more sugar than starch in those kernels. The super sweets don't have quite as tender a bite. It's a slightly different texture. However, they hold their sweetness longer, both on the stalk and after they're picked. So even if a super sweet is left on the stalk a few days past what you might consider its optimal size, it is still going to be sweet. Now, in my opinion, I have sacrificed a little bit of kernel tenderness, but I'm starting to fall in love with a lot of the super sweet varieties. And now there's another type called triple sweet. This is an ear of corn that's developed with some percent sugary enhanced kernels and some percent super sweet kernels. Kind of a best of both worlds, varieties like Serendipity. So know whether the variety you're buying is one of the older SE sugary enhanced, or if it's one of the super sweets. Also keep in mind there are yellow corns and white corns and bicolor corns. And in my opinion, if they're picked at the right maturity and cooked at the right time, they are all spectacular. I've had some wonderful sweet corn this year. If you haven't had any yet, this is the perfect weekend to go out and try some. It's embarrassing, but with just 2 of us at home, we can easily eat a couple dozen ears of corn a week. Enjoy fresh sweet corn in coastal North Carolina, and I'll talk to you in next week's entry in the Garden Journal.
The first ever Crystal Coast Music Festival is happening Saturday on the Bogue Sound waterfront, featuring an eclectic mix of Americana performed by local, regional, and national artists. This week, I spoke with festival organizer Kerry Youngblood about the event and his passion for sharing this style of music with Eastern North Carolina.
I have attended a lot of festivals and have a real penchant for Americana music that I both play and mostly function as a consumer. And when I got here 4 years ago, I saw real potential to host a small festival. And it took us about 4 years to develop the relationships and get the sponsors. And this is our first ever festival, and I hope it's not our last. We plan for it to be an annual event.
You mentioned that you are a musician. What instrument do you play?
Well, I'm a songwriter and I sing, but I play guitar. And then for about the last 10 years, I've primarily played an instrument typically referred to as a gitjo, which is a combination of a guitar and a banjo.
So how does being a musician yourself kind of help you plan out this event?
Jared, I'm almost 60, and I've been going to festivals since I was a teenager. So I know what festivals need to ensure that their customers are going to have a positive experience. I've also played at numerous festivals as a musician, so I understand the needs of the musicians, because the people that buy tickets need to be happy when they go away, and the musicians need to be happy when they go away.
You said before there's been about 4 years of planning, all culminating with this weekend's event. Tell me, what can people expect?
Well, what people can expect is easy access, readily available parking. We have the Civic Center for them to be, our local small Civic Center, for people to be able to go inside and eat or cool off if it's too hot. And we've hired a high-level professional sound company to provide a professional stage and sound. So they can expect some world-class music in a beautiful small venue, easy to access, and we've also hand-selected 4 food vendors. We have one of our sponsors is R.A. Jeffries. They're the Budweiser distributor. So we'll have basic Budweiser products as well as an array of on-tap craft beers.
Now, as far as the lineup for this year's Crystal Coast Music Festival, Porch Dog Revival is going to be kicking off the event, followed by North Carolina's Young Artist of the Year, Liz Lauren, and local favorite, Unknown Tongues.
I don't know a more entertaining group of folks, Brian and Barbara Blake, who are local folks that live in the Gloucester area here, have founded that band over 20 years ago, and they play a lot of original Cajun Zydeco-style music. They're really a lot of fun. They have diverse instrumentation, and Brian Blake is a very talented multi-instrumentalist. They will be followed by the perennial favorites of the East Coast, the Atlanta-based Blue Dogs. One couple contacted me from South Carolina, and they're coming, and they said, the night we met was at a Blue Dogs concert 15 years ago. So the Blue Dogs mix roots rock, acoustic, and Americana, and sort of create their own sound.
Now, one of the acts that people are really looking forward to is Peter Rowan.
I don't know anyone else with a career as deep and as diverse as Peter Rowan. Peter has albums out from traditional bluegrass to reggae to sort of jazzy singer-songwriter kinds of things. He's going to be playing with a group of musicians that call themselves Twang and Groove. So it's a little more eclectic, it's a little less traditional, and Peter will put on an outstanding show no matter what.
I stand before you now, my friend. A poor but honest man.
And of course, the headliner for the first ever Crystal Coast Music Festival is the infamous String Dusters.
I have seen hundreds of string bands type instruments in all formats, and I don't know, I've never seen a single one that is any better, and few are equal to the virtuoso acumen that the individual members of this band possess, and more importantly, they play together as a band. This is not your grandfather's bluegrass music. For folks that are unfamiliar with them, they are extraordinary musicians. They put on an outstanding show, and we're real happy to have them here.
Carrie Youngblood is the organizer for this weekend's Crystal Coast Music Festival on the Bogue Sound waterfront at Carteret Community College in Moorhead City from noon until 11:30 p.m. Thanks for speaking with me.
We really appreciate Public Radio East, your sponsorship as a media sponsor, and we really want to encourage folks to come out. I do want to mention that this entire thing is a fundraiser for the Downtown Moorhead Revitalization Authority and the Carteret Community College Foundation.
If you'd like more information on the Crystal Coast Music Festival, go to publicradioeast.org.